One of the things that I'm particularly interested in is speaking to people around the world, and particularly young people, because, you know, I think everybody in each country has a view of what's happening, and it's not representative of what's happening in different countries in the world. So this is as much to understand about Serbia, which is a country I've spent good time in back in 1997. I was in charge of Coca-Cola for Central Europe and in charge of Serbia and Kosovo and Croatia, etc. So I have a nice feeling, and I had some very nice friends and people working for me in Serbia. So it's also as much because I like the country and I like the people and I have a history there. So perhaps the first thing you could tell us is, you know, where are you right now?
I'm located in Belgrade, in Serbia. That's in southeastern Europe, below the Danube and above Greece. Just how I explain it to people who have no idea of the geographic place, but yes.
Fantastic. So if you were to look out of your window, just because, again, it's always helpful for us to literally have an image of where you are, your surroundings, can you just paint a picture of what we would be seeing if we were with you?
Yes, I would say that I'm quite fortunate to have a balcony in front of me and quite a nice view. I'm overlooking what... is the beginning of the flatlands that cover northern Serbia and Hungary, with a little mountain range there, which is also a national park. And well, on clear days, which is fortunately not today, when there's no pollution, you can also see the Ser Mountains, which are almost the border with Bosnia. And you can see the little range that I mentioned here, which goes almost into Croatia. So it's actually, especially when there's a storm, quite spectacular.
And what is the weather like now? What is the weather like in Serbia? How would you describe the weather over the full year, perhaps, actually, even?
The past month has been heat wave after heat wave, which is quite uncomfortable. But it's a continental climate, so extremely hot, extremely cold, a lot of variation between years. From what I've heard, this variation is also increasing, which I think also ties into the subject under discussion now. But of course, that has consequences on my life of, you know, slight discomforts and having to turn on the AC, while otherwise I wouldn't. But for other people's lives that depend on weather, these changes have much more drastic repercussions, including having to, for example, change farming strategies from, let's say, a more from a summer planting, so planting in spring, harvesting in autumn, to planting in autumn and harvesting in spring.
We'll come on to that because we want to talk a lot about this area of focus. And just give us a couple of points about your background. You know, what did you study? And then a little bit perhaps what your focus is now. I don't want you to say everything because we're going to talk a lot about that. But
yeah, I'll keep it in a nutshell. I studied economics with a, let's say, minor in international development studies. Inspired to go a little bit more practical. I studied natural resource management in plant science. Well, I assumed it was more practical at the time. And after that, I started with consulting. It was quite undirected in general. But yeah, it was started off, let's say, in this kind of innovation field. Of course, has continued since then, but also has picked up on several quite interesting, I would say, areas, including, for example, the use of satellite data for applications, which is a very interesting field.
And what prompted you to obviously change from economics to plant science, but also to be therefore interested in sustainability in its broader sense? What was the tipping point that led you in this direction?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess in youth, you're a little bit searching for something. And it was just a thread, I guess, that pulled back once you kind of tugged at it. I guess it was in between jobs. We had a compost pit in the kitchen I was working in. And in the overall understanding, not to mention the huge wastage that was there, of these food systems and, you know, the connection to welfare and, you know, if you take it further to development was, you know, an interesting topic that was inspiring enough to attract me further.
Yes.
I think. In simple terms, that's how I would put it.
Good. So actually, you said you were in a kitchen. Did I hear that properly? So just, I'm sure there's a story there. Just tell us a teeny bit about that because that's intriguing.
Yeah, it started out as in between jobs in university and kept going afterwards. And well, it was very interesting for a while, but of course it's quite, how can I say, repetitive job. And at a certain point you want more stimulation. So, you know, these whole questions that I brought up with regards to what I mentioned, I feel that they kind of come from there, not entirely. I mean, also from education and other experiences, but I think that's what kind of really pushed me to say, okay, you know, what do I have? I have a brain, I have an understanding. This is the direction that I should be looking in, because, you know, there's something there, and, you know, let's jump into it. Let's go in that direction.
Great. No, it's good to hear those stories, because it can be small things that tip one, or you get an insight outside of just, you know, universities and so on. So if we look, I could say the Balkans, but I think I prefer to say Serbia, because Serbia is a country in itself, and that's where you are, and that's where you've grown up. So what would be the picture you would paint of the environmental dynamics that's going on at a macro level in Serbia? You've mentioned a teeny bit already, but paint the full picture, please.
I think Serbia is rather representative of the region, which includes both EU member states and, let's say aspiring EU member states. Of course, every country has its own differences and particularities, but I think overall the environment here, I mean, these were generally not highly industrialized societies, and, you know, that's the legacy going into the 21st century. However, there is a focus on economic development, which is the most important. In some part, this has also included exporting, let's say, polluting industries and polluting activities in general to this area, which, on the other hand, of course, this is not the positive side, but on the other hand, this has also inspired, you know, a local kind of environmental awareness, which is not only appearing, but also growing and forming. And you see also similarities between countries, which is quite interesting. I mean, one very, very simple example is this, they call them mini hydro power stations, I guess, which essentially means that you take a small river, you put it in a tube, and you have it, you know, generate electricity through the power generated. I mean, in the Balkans, there's a lot of people who still live in rural areas that depend on this river water for their existence. So the environmental issues are closely linked to rural well-being, on the one hand. On the other hand, there's also this push towards industrialization. There's quite a heavy use of coal here and quite bad air quality. And there's still relatively small, but I would say quite growing, and even movement with quite some similarities between countries, which I find quite interesting, to address these rising environmental problems. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that there is a push from the EU and, of course, associated funding to address environmental concerns. But these, to a large part, have been external values that have been kind of, you know, projected onto here. But with people realizing what that means and relating to it from their own personal lives and how it affects it and those of people around them, it's a lot more powerful to interpret what environmentalism means here. And yeah, for me, that's actually a very, very positive sign, the reaction. Of course, the negative is, of course, a lot less positive. But I think this reactionary momentum is quite necessary for, generally the environmental movement, but also to build consciousness, which allows a movement towards a higher valorization of the environment and what value that has for society.
One of the things I think I've observed going around the world is that, let's say, in the super developed EU countries, many people are very cut off from the land. Now, obviously, there are lots of farmers, and some cultures are very close to the land. But, you know, the urbanization of people means that, you know, I'm probably four or five generations away from the land. And yet we go to a country like Serbia or the Balkans where perhaps it would be fair to say there's a closer proximity. Perhaps the grandparents are still farmers, or even the parents. So how would you say that's a fair reflection? And how would you describe that relationship between the land and farming and the average person? Let's start with that.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair characterization. I mean, to describe what it means would really go into, I don't know if even PhD would be fair to say. I think poetry would be closer to, you know, reality. But yeah, I would say that there's a closer connection to the land. The only, I think, challenge here, I mean, I think this pattern exists around the world, where, as you say, industrialization is later in coming, and you had, you know, people come. And I remember my grandparents also, actually across from the river here where I'm looking, when they moved into the apartment buildings, they found, you know, a plot of land. And of course, they weren't the only ones. They also came from rural settings, other people who were moving into that area, which was, you know, a new construction, a new urbanization project. And they were growing their own vegetables, I mean, which was normal for, you know, for their way of life up till then. Of course, with advancing urbanization, that opportunity disappeared, which was very curious to see, for example, in Western Europe, it reappearing as a, you know, kind of a thought out scheme, which is genius, of course. In terms of what it can mean, as I say, I think that's quite complex. On the one hand, it can be part of the identity. So, you know, that you, for example, get certain agricultural products, that you have, you know, solarization of homemade, well, homegrown vegetable or home chicken or, you know, homemade brandies or anything of the sort. But I think that that's also quite international, because I think this is something which I've seen actually, this value of that kind of authenticity and quality also reappearing in Western Europe. On the other hand, there's also, you know, the negative side, which is the stereotypes, the, you know, assumed primitiveness and all these things. So I really think it's quite a difficult dimension to look at, but it definitely has consequences on the cultural dimension. And it also, interestingly, can offer, let's say, a discussion space for public at large for environmental issues. Because as I mentioned, these kind of grassroots movements, they're talking about protecting our land. They have a national aspect to them, a patriotic, I would say, aspect to them, which is quite appropriate. But if that's also interlinked to this connection to the land, that could actually be quite powerful, I think.
So you are involved in a concept called carbon farming. Would you like to explain from the beginning? Because this is a brand new idea to me, and I'd love to hear and learn with you about it.
Yes. Carbon farming refers to having farms produce carbon credits. This is through using, well, the assets that they have at their disposal, primarily land, to be repurposed as carbon sinks. This would refer to adopting and implementing certain practices that lead to a higher portion of carbon being sequestered in land. I mean, land is, of course, a natural carbon sink. This would be changing farm systems towards enhancing the ability of farms to act as carbon sinks. As I say, primarily through the land, but also through planting trees, for example. That's what the woodland scheme in the UK relates to. And, well, rewetting of wetlands and other such things. So essentially harvesting natural potential for land and land-based activities to store carbon. The idea there is that this potential can be used, well, of course, to offset emissions, and that this can in turn be rewarded so that farmers can get some benefit from it. Often carbon credits are actually touted, are promoted as a mechanism to do so. Carbon farming, I think, is important to mention, is gained quite a lot of attention recently. When we kind of entered the picture, it was still in this initial discussion, and it was more related to how can we reward you know, farmers that have already made changes that are more sustainable, more regenerative. I mean, various words are used: agroecological, climate smart. But recently it's received quite a lot of policy attention, how to essentially support a transition to a more sustainable farming. Overall, I think it's a great initiative, a good way of thinking about it, but it is only part of the solution and requires quite a lot more work, because soil itself, or let's say properties of soil, agricultural soil or any other soil, are difficult to measure across space and across time. And by difficult, I mean costly, rather than that technology, of course, exists, and therefore requires novel approaches to address them. And that's personally my involvement, is in a European, actually a project funded by the European Union. This includes partners from 7 countries, including several from the UK. And we're trying to make, let's say, more sustainable regenerative farming simple and cheaper for farmers to adopt through providing a toolbox of satellite data-driven services that will contribute to monitoring, verifying, and reporting with regards to soil carbon.
Right. Wow,
quite a mouthful.
I want to unpack that because there's lots of interesting things. First of all, I would say carbon farming as an idea is quite stunning because you get it in one instance. You know, it doesn't have to be explained at all. And I haven't heard that word, and yet it sounds very contemporary and modern and exciting. So that's what would be an observation of mine. I think I'm interested to break down between what may be obvious, i.e. let's plant a bunch of trees and farm trees which engage carbon, which I think probably we don't understand, to what sounds more complicated or more scientific or less known, definitely to me, which is that the land itself can absorb carbon if you do something with it differently. So can you give us some more understanding of that? Because that sounds more scientific.
Well, I'm not a scientist, so I'll provide a kind of a layman's understanding, which is also my own. Essentially, if you leave farmland by itself, it'll most likely result in more carbon being stored in that piece of land, whatever the area is. I guess actually the story goes back to what happens before a piece of land was farmland. It was a certain, let's say, plot that had, of course, some kind of greenery, some kind of biomass on top of it, which itself contains a certain amount of carbon. It contains a layer, usually a layer of topsoil, which is quite rich in organic matter. And this usually means that it's quite a stable storage of carbon. I mean, I'm simplifying quite a lot, but it implies that there's quite a lot of carbon that's held there. Of course, this becomes less and less as you go down in further into the soil until you eventually come to rocks, essentially. When you start converting this into farmland, on the one hand, you're getting rid of the biomass on top. Most farmland by area is arable farmland, which means that it's most likely tilled. It's most likely annual crops that are planted there. The process of cultivation also promotes the release of this stable layer of topsoil so that the overall carbon content is slowly shrinking, which is actually also quite a problem for agriculture. So actually carbon farming is kind of a win-win-win if you can get it right. In turn, carbon farming is saying that there are certain practices that increase this diminish the amount through which the topsoil diminishes. There's other farming practices that can promote the accumulation of carbon in this topsoil, and that having farmers switch towards practices, of course, on a large scale, that result in a greater storage of carbon in agricultural lands, particularly in the topsoil, can be part of the solution to mitigating climate change and avoiding the worst.
So is the scale of this sufficient to make a dent in climate change? And is it sufficient to really offset? By the way, I'm a great cynic of offsetting. It all just seems too easy. But nonetheless, that's another story. Excuse me. So what's the sort of scale are we talking about? You know, how much, have you got some numbers on what could be absorbed or can be absorbed?
I do have numbers, but I didn't
don't worry.
Them. Okay. I could actually open them up. I was looking at them today. I mean, in simple words, it's not enough. There are actually, it also depends who you ask. There's a lot of people who say, you know, the potential is enormous. They can solve all our problems. I don't think that's true. I think the assumptions there and, you know, the way that the available information was scaled was not done in a way that reflects the actual potential. Because, of course, if you look at dry land, which has very little topsoil, you can't assume that it can accumulate as much as a place where it was naturally accumulated. So I think overall, it's definitely not enough. It's a step in the right direction. And it's an opportunity for a financial instrument to support farmer decision-making towards moving to more regenerative practices, towards more sustainable practices. And that's very positive because a lot of the kind of institutional framework and a lot of the economic incentives so far have been going in the opposite direction. They've been promoting production, which is part of the problem. You know, in intensive production overall is leading to these problems that I mentioned. That's a quite a large generalization, but I think it's quite safe to say at this point. So once again, carbon farming, I think, is part of the solution. It's definitely not enough. And indeed, it's only part of the offsetting solution. Agriculture by itself is a huge emitter. I think if the entire value chain of agriculture is accounted for, this can in the EU be around 15%. In the UK, it's around the same. On the world scale, I think it's actually a little bit larger. But it's definitely not enough. We have to change everything very simply.
So satellites, or no, actually, before I get to satellites, I think I'm understanding you to say that if you have a carbon emitter like an airline and they want to offset, they have to basically, you know, fund an offsetting. You go to the farm and say, we can subsidize you, if that's the right word, or we will pay you to undertake agriculture in a certain way, which will accelerate the absorption of CO2. So that may be less productive from a food point of view, but that gap is going to be covered by the fact that you're actually planting CO2 as opposed to planting plants. That's basically the model. Is that correct?
Yes, in short, that's a good way to put it. The actual mechanisms of doing this goes through quite a lot of intermediaries. That's why I have to say the government stepping in and supporting these programs is actually quite welcome, because they're also going to be using these offsets towards their own offsets, to meet their international obligations. On the other hand, it's not only about the offsets, of course. I mean, you're taking certain measures and, you know, which results in better agriculture. You can then also look at other consequences that this can have on the farm economics. For example, if you're producing things more sustainably, can you also start selling your produce for a larger farm gate price? So it's carbon farming in terms of the components, which is a reward for increasing carbon stored in soils, mostly in soils, is just part of the picture. And it's, since there's a huge variety of farms, it's really hard to generalize what an overall carbon farming strategy can be. Yeah. But on the large scale, to ensure that this can become more widespread, it's definitely not enough just to talk about revenue from offsets.
Right. Okay. Now, coming back to satellites, that's intriguing. So could you explain the role of satellites in this program?
Yes. So, I mean, satellites are kind of an eye in the sky, right? Not only can they take pictures from space, but since they are using other sensors as well, such as radar. Once again, not a professional, so a layman's understanding. You can also see through clouds, which allows you to observe the Earth. In fact, using satellites to study the planet is called Earth observation. And that was the original consideration, scientific, particularly with regards to the environment, and also for security applications. However, since these programs are extremely expensive, and there is quite a lot of data that's generated, you know, it can clearly be used for other things. So this is kind of where the entire industry, the Earth observation industry, is looking at. There's a wealth of data. There's a focus on digitalization and use of data across the economy. Where does space data fit in? In agriculture, I mean, the most obvious way to frame the value proposition is that it can see across large spaces. It can update this quite frequently, depending on which satellite data is used. Just as a quick example, the European Union has its own satellite system. Actually, so does NASA. But the European Union one has refreshes images every 5 to 7 days. Depends which location in the world we're talking about. Depends also which kind of imagery. But there are other private constellations, so essentially commercial systems, including one of the partners on this project, that have daily images, which can be very useful in certain parts of the season for a farm. And indeed, that's kind of what we're also trying to see in this project. What is the scope for using publicly available satellite data, and where do we need private commercial data for the added value?
So are you able, through the satellite imaging, to detect the amount of CO2 in a particular piece of Earth? Is that what fundamentally you're trying to do?
Absolutely not.
Oh. There you are, I'm giving you a free idea. That's how you should use it. Anyway, carry on.
Well, it's very difficult. I mean, the short answer there is that satellite images are quite useful for seeing something, but that something is usually not enough in general. Specifically to this problem, satellite images can't see through the ground. They can't directly measure what is there. However, they can be used in a variety of ways to estimate carbon and other soil properties. For example, there's several approaches, but I'll actually give an indication of our approach, which is working together with farmers to collect on-farm data. So we know exactly in this point what is going on. We know exactly in this point here what is going on in terms of soil properties. Then we analyze a lot of satellite data, which gives us an indication of soil patterns.
Yeah.
And through that, we can create a map using certain patterns that we're finding in the field based on growth, based on other things, and the two points that we have to come up with a better estimate of what is the soil status across the field.
Right. So the reason I said it can read CO2, I'm being actually quite serious, and I think you are saying it can do that to some degree. If we just hear how astronomers are able to say, you know, the composition of some star, you know, 2 billion miles away, they obviously are picking up somehow elemental coding, for want of a better word, to determine it. So I was just assuming that there must be some sort of refractive index or reflective index or absorption rates that gives you a sense of density or carbon within a particular photograph. I mean, is that what you're implying you're able to do through the example you've just given, or is it still further away than that?
It's our approach is slightly different. There are, research approaches that are proposing exactly what you're saying,
right.
Essentially spectroscopy of soil. There's two challenges there. One is that you need bare soil to do that. And you still, well, at least my understanding is that you need to know a little bit more about the local conditions, so how wet the soil is. I'm not sure if I'm entirely correct on that, though. The second one is that to be able to do that, you need quite a large, large amount of reference data. They call this a spectral library, unless I'm mistaken.
Yeah.
Which then, of course, through certain algorithms, you train the algorithm to recognize, you know, this is most likely this, this is most likely that. Besides the fact that you need bare soils for this, the accuracy is also not, perhaps it's not the highest, if I can put it that way. And the question is, what accuracy do you actually need for this application of, measuring changes in carbon? Because if the changes are only, 0.5% in 3 years, is the accuracy of the measurement technique sufficient to pick up on it?
Yep.
Or is it overlapping to the point where you say, it's most likely zero? That's actually the challenge.
Okay.
I think what's really important there is that the carbon farming challenge, which is really monitoring, reporting, and verification, it does have a space for, novel technologies. So, use of satellite data, big data approaches like machine learning. However, going back to the old technology things, it also requires, buy-in from the farmers and their participation. Both from the social innovation side to, have them accept this and, get the initiative moving, but also in terms of the data which they have, which is incredibly valuable for increasing the accuracy of these predictions.
So last couple of points, is there a good place where this is happening? Have you got a good example of either a farm or an area where, this is really being adopted even in an experimental way?
Yes, there's several. We have 5 pilots ourselves. The project did start at the beginning of this year, so we're only in month 6.5 now. And we are in initial phases of testing there. There are slightly more advanced examples actually around the world. There's a couple in the United States. There's a couple in Europe. A particularly good example would be the Soil Carbon Coalition. Probably double check that in the Netherlands. which is, I think, an example of how this challenge should be approached. The specific background there was that it was a top-down initiative, which is essentially a bank and an insurance group wanted information on soil to inform their decisions about their financial decisions about their core business. And they hired a group to create a solution for it. But having created the solution, they realized that satellite data is not enough and that it requires working together with farmers. And then they brought in people, they defined the governance principles, they defined how to interact on this. I think that's actually quite a good example of how to go about, you know, doing it right, ensuring that it survives for quite a long time and that it's a lot more widespread.
Very good. So last point, if I was a farmer and I heard this podcast and I wanted to, you know, get a tip or trick from you as to how I might get involved or take an action here, what would be your advice to the farmers listening as to, you know, how they could get involved and benefit from this?
Well, firstly, I would recommend to visit our website of the project I mentioned. So agricapturecO2.eu. Secondly, there's quite a lot of local initiatives going on. I would recommend everybody Google it, which can be carbon farming locally. There's quite a lot of hits that would come up. But also to be quite skeptical, because a lot of current initiatives, and there really are from more publicly supported ones to completely private ones, to really see what the terms and the requirements are. Right. Because a commitment for 5 years, for example, without knowing much about what is going on and without seeing too many results, I think would be quite a risky thing to do.
Very interesting. So, well, look, Igor, I think this is completely fascinating. I'm really excited to have learned about this because, as I say, it's completely new, yet seems very captivating. And as you said, the application of satellites and a combination of advanced data with very simple farming, is fascinating. And I've actually got a couple of multinational companies who are in the farming business for their beginning products who are wanting to know new ways that they can contribute to sustainability. And I'm going to tell them about this because I think this would be very exciting for them, very contemporary, and they have not mentioned they know about it. So thank you. And I wish you great luck in this journey and hope to hear perhaps in a year or so how you've got on.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. And please do recommend us. We'd be more than glad to bring more stakeholders to the table, so to say, as we, of course, always learn from this experience as well. And of course, I'd be very glad to follow up with you as well on the subject.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you very much.